This hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by the KTTH live coverage of tomorrow night's debate between President Trump and the former Vice President Joe Biden. We're going to be carrying that live, commercial-free, starting at 6 o'clock tomorrow, right here on KTTH. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? National.
So, over the weekend, President Trump nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. This will be the replacement for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And in doing so, he put Democrats in an impossibly tough position that so far they've shown complete political ineptitude on. Because by any reasonable standard, regardless of whether or not you identify as a Republican or a Democrat, ACB, as people are calling her, she is a brilliant jurist. She is incredibly well-liked. She is eminently qualified to be on the Supreme Court. No matter who you talk to that is familiar with her, regardless of ideology, they say that exact same thing. You had in the Washington Post a hardcore legal mind on the left praising her and her temperament on the court. And on top of that, she happens to be one of like the nicest people ever. Someone who's been described as a kind soul. She's a mother of seven, including a special needs child and two children that she and her husband adopted from Haiti. This is a good person. She is not easy to attack. Now, the left went after Brett Kavanaugh because he's a cisgendered white dude. They were able to do that. And they had something in a Me Too era to attack him on, even though it was shown to be completely bogus. They can't do that with ACB. They can't really directly attack her as a woman, although some people have tried. But for the most part, the establishment Democrats have not been able to do that, nor will they do it. It's a bad look, especially at a time where you've got a whole bunch of women, suburban women, getting ready to cast their vote. Do they want to see the Democrats go after a mother of seven who has shown not only can she be a successful mom and a good person to boot, but also brilliant? Do they really want to see Democrats do that? No. They're not going to get in the way of this kind of history, but they got to do something. So what did the Democrats decide to do? They are turning to her religion. It turns out Amy Coney Barrett is a devout Catholic. And so that's what they're using to attack. I would argue that would also backfire, but they're going to do it anyway. How do we know they're going to do it? Well, because for starters, they're already doing it. They did it over the weekend. They did it this morning. Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, for example, was on with MSNBC. And by the way, prior to the statement that you're about to hear, she had already come out to say she is voting no. She does not think Amy Coney Barrett belongs on the Supreme Court because she believes that ACB is going to overturn policies that she supports. But listen to this performance.
Do you have any concerns about her being a woman of faith, a devout woman of faith, and getting in the way of her being able to do her duty? Or do you believe people can actually be practicing Catholics and devout Christians and still be an effective judge?
Joe, her religion is immaterial. The issue is whether she can separate her deeply held views on issues like abortion, LGBTQ rights, whether she can separate her deeply held views from her ability to be fair and objective as a justice sitting there for years making decisions that impact all of our lives, starting with the Affordable Care Act.
Oof, lots of code words there, huh? Because in the same breath that she says her religion is immaterial, she also says, I don't know if she could put aside her deeply held beliefs. What deeply held beliefs do you think she's talking about? She's talking about her religious beliefs. That's why the first thing that she put out there was abortion rights. But second, that's a bad argument. Everyone has deeply held beliefs. Literally everyone has a deeply held belief or two or million, religious or otherwise. So suddenly that's disqualifying. That's disqualifying. She's not arguing that ACB hasn't pushed aside her deeply held beliefs, religious or otherwise. That's not what she's arguing. She's just wondering aloud, I wonder if she's capable of that. You do realize we've got a record of her rulings, yeah? She's been on the bench for 3 years. You can go ahead and point directly to some rulings if you think she wasn't able to argue the law, but instead was arguing for her political or religious positions. Like, just show me the ruling and let's have that conversation. But they don't have any of those rulings. They knew Amy Coney Barrett was going to be the nominee. We talked about it last week, and we talked about during the Brett Kavanaugh stuff. ACB was supposed to be the choice, but they didn't want to pick her at that point because they realized that most likely Justice Ginsburg would end up stepping down. In this case, she didn't step down, she passed away. Democrats knew that. You don't think they spent all this time looking at her record for anything? And all they can find, as they've shown so far at least, some speeches she gave in which she supported, wait for it. You know what she supported? God and religion. Oh my God. She called abortion immoral. You can call abortion immoral. You can call abortion moral and still rule on law in a way that conflicts with your personal views. I have to assume judges do this every single day. They look at the law and they decide. The good ones do. The bad ones don't. The bad ones release prolific offenders back into the community to offend again. But this is the strategy. In some ways, a subtle jab at her religion. In other ways, a not-so-subtle jab at her religion. And my assumption is they think that they can do this because maybe they think it does the least amount of damage to the Democratic base, causes the least amount of anger to the base. I don't know if that's a good strategy. It's probably wrong. I think if you're a Democrat in the South, for example, or a Democrat who happens to be in a minority community, they tend to hold those demographics different views on religion than, say, the godless heathen of Seattle. I say that only half jokingly. But we should not be shocked that this is the strategy, that this is the attack, because back when she was being appointed to the circuit court, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California went after her religion.
Why is it that so many of us on this side have this very uncomfortable feeling that, you know, dogma and law are two different things?
Maybe because you're a religious bigot?
And I think whatever a religion is, it has its own dogma. The law is totally different. And I think in your case, Professor, when you read your speeches,
spit it out, come on.
The conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you.
Okay, Yoda, thank you so much. Now, in doing so, Dianne Feinstein made it so easy for Republicans to push back at what is very clearly animus towards religion. At least her religion. A conservative who happens to be deeply religious is an enemy, is dangerous. A liberal who happens to be deeply religious, oh, it's all good. They're definitely not going to mix the two. This was such a bad look that even Jeffrey Toobin over at CNN, their legal analyst, absolutely shredded Feinstein for these comments.
One person who was not thanked during this ceremony was one of the people who was most responsible for Amy Coney Barrett being nominated to the Supreme Court, and that's Senator Dianne Feinstein, who in 2017, when she was the ranking Democrat on the committee, engaged in questioning of now Judge Barrett that was so incompetent, so inept, so apparently religiously discriminatory that Amy Coney Barrett became a hero to religious conservatives. You know, Dianne Feinstein was and is a distinguished public servant who has served for many years on the Supreme Court. She is now 87 years old, and she has repeatedly engaged in behavior in recent months that seem out of step with what Democrats want to do.
Yeah, because she is out of step with what Democrats want to do. This is going to be fun. It's going to be a fun and interesting battle. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message and weigh in. 1-800-465-8770. When we come back, we're going to dive into a local controversy where a Snohomish County Council member seemingly posted a image that kind of almost tacitly endorses Molotov cocktail attacks on cops. We're going to get into this when we come back. Don't forget, tomorrow night, 6 p.m. sharp, we will be carrying the live debate between President Trump and Joe Biden. It will be uninterrupted, following by live analysis from Fox News. You're not going to want to miss that. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Back the blue.
So right now, all across the region, but especially in the Pacific Northwest, we've seen a rise in attacks against law enforcement. There has been a surge. And as this is happening, a Snohomish County Council member decided to post a quote-unquote good reminder to use Molotov cocktails? Huh? Megan Dunn is the council member. She's on the Snohomish County Council. She represents the 2nd District, and that includes Everett. She posted this imagery and message on her personal Facebook account. And after a whole bunch of people pointed out how ridiculous and odious it was, she ended up deleting it. But people took screenshots, and a controversy was born. In this post, she shows an image of a stitching that depicts a Molotov cocktail, and on it, it reads the text, "Be the light you want to see in the world." In her post, accompanying this particular image, she wrote that it is not my stitch project, but a good reminder. A good reminder? To use a Molotov cocktail? That's the good reminder? You think that's a good reminder? That, of course, is a vile message. It's a dangerous message. And it's not happening in a bubble, right? She's not just putting this in a world in which nothing around us is happening that should remind you of the dangers of using Molotov cocktails. There was a Molotov cocktail attack against police officers last week, the week before that, and the week before that. The East Precinct, the office for the Seattle Police Officers Guild, SPOG, they both faced and continue to face Molotov cocktail attacks. Last weekend in Portland, there was the viral video of an attempted murder of a Portland police officer after someone threw a Molotov cocktail at them. That's the conduct that you're telling us is a good reminder to what engage in? Now, the Everett Police Officers Association, the president of which is going to be on the show at 5:45, they called out Megan Dunn on Twitter, asking her to resign and apologize. They wrote, "Promoting violence and murder against our law enforcement professionals and destruction of our community is not acceptable from anyone. It's a crime." And so I reached out to Megan Dunn, who presented me a statement that she just posted on her Facebook page, saying, I didn't intend to promote any kind of violence. She says, "My post of a counterculture cross-stitching project was in no way intended as a call for violence or encouraging violence. It does not reference police or violence against police and has no imagery of police. I'm sorry, but what do you immediately think of when we're talking about a Molotov cocktail? Well, what do you think normal human beings would take from that?" A police officer doesn't have to be a part of the imagery for immediately people thinking of that. So why exactly would you highlight this one particular message and image? How is a Molotov cocktail not intended to promote violence? Is there another use for Molotov cocktails
Yeah, you ever been down like a dark hallway and you just need to be able to see?
Okay.
You light a
Molotov. You light one?
Yeah, you light a Molotov cocktail and then you use it instead of like a flashlight.
Oh, you still throw it at someone at the end of the night though, right?
Of course, that's how you get rid of it. You're not supposed to put those out with water. Are you
kidding
me?
What are you supposed to do? So she goes, I did not make the connection with this image as violence against police, but rather as a reminder to continue to strive for systemic reforms and being brighter than a candle for the change you want to see in the world. If you fall for that, it's hard for me to explain the level of, I was going to say, let me not say stupid because that's mean. I was going to say a level of stupidity that knows no bounds. Well, I'm going to be nicer about it. You show an alarming amount of naivete. That's it. That was nicer.
Wow. That was like an elegant way to call her stupid.
Totally. She's not stupid. She thinks you're stupid. Megan Dunn is not stupid. Unless she thought we were going to fall for that nonsense, then I suppose. But I think she actually believes people are stupid. Right now, activists on the streets are pushing for systemic change while using Molotov cocktails. But she's telling us the image and the idea of using a Molotov cocktail is not connected to violence against police, but somehow is a reminder to continue to strive for systemic reforms. She's actually weirdly arguing my case more than I did before I attacked her. That's remarkable. And she is panicking right now, as she should, because of the political fallout. People are calling her, and she's calling them back. In fact, one of her constituents, whose name we're going to keep to ourselves, forwarded me the voicemail that she left trying to walk this back.
Hi, this is Megan Dunn from Snohomish County Council. I'm returning your phone call. I removed the picture from my personal Facebook profile of the Let Your Light Shine. It was, just a joke on...
Uh-huh. Now it was a joke. I thought it was an inspiration.
Metaphor, I'd say, for...
She's
it's obviously not in support of using Molotov cocktails.
Obviously, you're the one who posted it.
I mean to be intended to be offensive, so I removed it from my personal Facebook. So thank you for sharing your concerns with me and calling. I did not mean to offend your friend or people who have been injured, obviously, in accidents. So if you have any questions, you can call me back. Thank you.
Okay. If you want to actually see this image and help shine a spotlight on this story, because she doesn't want you to, text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. Text R-A-N-T-Z to 1-800-465-8770. I'll go ahead and send you a link so you can see the post, and you can share it on your own Facebook wall and Twitter feed. KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. The Edmond School District ended their school resource officer contracts with the Edmonds, Linwood, and Mount Lake Terrace Police Department. So that begs the question, what's the plan if, God forbid, some emergency actually happens on one of the campuses at the school at the schools in the district? Joining me on the line to discuss is the Assistant Superintendent Greg Schwab. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So it was basically just a few weeks ago where the school board unanimously voted to get rid of the SROs because students claim to, quote, feel unsafe in our schools. And they basically took that position after the killing of George Floyd. And they thought, hey, police officers present make us uncomfortable. So what's the plan to keep them safe should something unthinkable actually happen?
Well, A couple of things to know about that. So the first thing to know is that, you know, in the event that that unthinkable incident happens in one of our schools, the response that we're going to get from law enforcement is going to be quite robust. You know, I think we have all seen examples in other schools that where these events have happened, and we're gonna receive support from every available police officer, even outside of our local jurisdictions. That's just, you know, I've had lots of conversations with our law enforcement partners, and mm-hmm. you know, they've assured me that in those kinds of situations, we can count on the cavalry showing up, because those are the kinds of sure. events that that are just such a high priority. So we'll
it
see.
Would be slower
we'll
see
a pretty
though.
Heavy response,
right? I mean, there's certainly an acknowledgement that it would be slower to have a law enforcement official interact with a potential shooter or someone else on campus because you no longer have someone on the campus.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So number two.
Oh, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second. So the second thing is that we're also working with our local jurisdictions to re-implement a program that we had in place back in the mid-2000s when we had to reduce school resource officers for budgetary reasons. And it's called a liaison officer model. And essentially what we do is work with our local partners to assign a duty officer that's on patrol that would be responsible for having the school be part of their beat, so to speak. And so in those instances when a school had a 911 call for, you know, any of a variety of reasons that a school might call 911, if that officer were available, that officer would be the one to respond to the school. One of the reasons we think this is a good model is because, one of the benefits of having a school resource officer was somebody that knows how schools operate.
Mm-hmm.
Schools are, you know, they're like small towns in many ways, especially large high schools, but they're also pretty unique places. And so having an officer that's familiar with the school staff, that's familiar with the operations of the school, is certainly something that would be an added benefit. So we're working with our local departments to replace the SRO with the liaison officer, so that we can maintain a little bit of that relationship with our law enforcement partners, and also make sure that we have some officers that know how our schools operate, that can respond if they're available to respond.
Yeah. And the big point is if they're available to respond, because they're obviously
sure,
not
yeah.
always going to be available. And again, you've sort of taken away a key resource that could be used to keep students safe, because it's not to say that the Montlake Terrace Police Department wouldn't do a really good job if they had to show up. It's that they're not going to know the campus the same way an SRO would know the campus. And so aren't you compromising the safety of the students a little bit more in that regard as well? Because obviously there's a compromise safety aspect to not having someone on campus.
Sure. I think there's certainly a lower level of service using a liaison officer model. I wouldn't try to tell you that it was commensurate with having a school resource officer. But, you know, this is what we have to work with right now. So we're going to do everything we can to put in place, you know, put those measures in place so that we have, you know, a measure of response. We're also, I think, working really hard to see what else we need to do mm-hmm. to provide, you know, a safe campus in our schools.
Sure.
We have, well, you know, one of the questions that we've heard a lot is, you know, that, well, not really a question, more of a statement. It's just, you know, a police officer by itself does not make a school safe, that there are other things we need to be doing as well, and making sure that we have, you know, appropriate resources and supports for our students, because the, you know, the resource officer is a reactionary model as opposed to a preventive model, and I think we need to get better at preventing these kinds of issues before they come to a crisis. So that's the other thing that we're engaging in this school year. We're going to spend that time, and fortunately we have a bright side of the pandemic, and the fact that we're on remote learning mm-hmm. right now, is we have some time to dig into this model and really do the work we need to do, so that when schools do reopen, you know, we'll have a full plan in place.
Assistant Superintendent Greg Schwab of the Edmonds School District is on the line. We're talking about the plan is now that the district decided to get rid of their school resource officer contracts, a plan to deal with, you know, if God forbid something were to happen. The likelihood, of course, is very low, but of course you do want to be prepared. Because I don't know exactly how this worked, when the school board decided to take this position and unanimously get rid of the role, did that reflect the viewpoint of both you and the superintendent?
Well, I think, you know, we understand that our school board had to, you know, is in the position of having to attend to the voices in our community. And quite honestly, this is not, this was not a new issue. The, you know, the incident, sure, the killing of George Floyd, I think certainly brought it to, you know, into a really intense light. But we've been hearing from, you know, our communities for, since we reinstated the SRO program back in 2018. You know, our communities of color really made it very clear to us that, you know, by having police officers in schools, we were not making our schools safer for a certain population of our, you know, certain segment of our school populations. And so we've
Is that factually accurate? Did it, in fact, not make schools safer for your students of color?
Well, I don't know that we have any data that would, you know, would.
But that's important. That's important, right? Let me ask it this way then, because I do think that this is an important part, because, you know, someone having a feeling, for example, of fear is different than someone literally being in a position where they are being hurt, for example. And I think that, you know, a community response or a school response should take that into account. Have any of your schools had any issues specifically with the school resource officer as far as, you know, overzealous enforcement, arrests that were wrong, any kind of brutality?
No, no.
So when then students say that they feel unsafe, there's no real evidence to suggest they were, in fact, unsafe beyond a feeling.
Well, I think that the, you know, how someone thinks or feels about a situation isn't right or wrong. It just is. And
sure, but I'm assuming that if a bunch of students came forward and said, we feel really, really safe, and then you had black students who said, I don't feel safe, you would be put in a position where you would have to make a judgment call. And presumably you would then at that point look at the data and say, okay, I understand, and I'll try to address, you know, one segment of the school community who feels unsafe, but just the data doesn't support it.
Yeah, and you're right. I can't refute that point. I think the and we did hear from both sides. I mean, to be fair, we did hear you know, our board heard a lot of public comment from community members who felt unsafe, and a lot of public comment from community members who felt very safe. And
but so you guys chose to side with the community that does not have any data on their side in this case. So how do you justify that?
Well,
I asked you if you were, because I know that you didn't make this decision. It was done with the school board. So that's why I asked, kind of like from your perspective and from the superintendent's perspective, did you actually support this move?
I think we tried to share our position with the board as best we could. And
what was that position?
Well, I think we see there's, you know, a school resource officer is an important part of a school's total safety, you know, school safety program. It's not the only thing that a school should be doing, but we also wanted to work with our board to help them understand. But I think our board was just put in a very difficult spot, and they had to make a judgment call. And at the end of the day, I support the decision the board made. And now my job is to say, okay, what are we going to do moving forward? And
would you have voted to get rid of the SROs then? Because it sounds like you would not have.
I'm not a voting member of the board, and so I'm going to refrain from answering that question.
I am also not a voting member of the board. I think it was a ridiculous position for them to take. But last question is, because I want to just focus on the logic behind this, because as you can tell, the logic to me doesn't really make sense. There have been cases, not just in Washington State, but across the country, of significant teacher abuse of students. And a while ago in your district, you had a teacher accused of having sex with a 17-year-old girl before and after class in their cars. Just a couple years ago, there was that middle school teacher, and I believe also a bus driver, both caught in the same underage sexting operation. If a student came forward, and maybe a handful of students came forward and said, look, we fear going to class because we don't want to be sexually assaulted or harassed by a teacher, you would not get rid of all of the teachers. So why then is this different?
That's a great question. And one that I don't know that I can answer that for you. I don't know how to answer that. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, we wouldn't. To follow your logic in this particular case, it probably, you know, from your lens, I can understand how you can say that it doesn't hold up. So
I'm assuming that from most lenses it wouldn't hold up, because it is an irrational position. We would all say, well, no, that's ridiculous. We're going to go after the teachers who are abusive. It's a very, very small percentage of the sort of the representation of the teachers. 99.9% of teachers don't do that, much like 99.9% of police officers don't do anything that would require them to go to jail for an illegal behavior. And by the way, with the exception of the Edmond School District, where 100% of the school resource officers have not done anything wrong. And so I just hope that you take that perspective moving forward and maybe present it. Because what it sounds like you're saying to me, and it's, and you're acknowledging right now, if students were in the district in classes, they are not as safe as they were when you had a police presence on campus. And I'll give you the final word.
Well, I wouldn't say they're not as safe. I would say that we are working really hard to make sure that we have measures in place that are going to keep them safe. And, you know, and again, I come back to school safety is not just a school resource officer. School safety is a whole program of supports for students that make our schools safer places. And so that's the work ahead of us, is we have to make sure that our schools are safe moving forward, and we're going to do that. We have a group right now that is working on the various measures that we plan to implement once we get back into face-to-face instruction, hopefully at some point this school year.
Fingers crossed.
And we will do everything we can to make sure that our schools are as safe as possible so that our students can learn and our teachers can teach.
Assistant Superintendent for the Edmond School District, Greg Schwab, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The Jason Rancho. If you want to weigh in, send me a text, 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. Welcome back to The Jason Ranch Show on this Monday afternoon. I want to talk to you briefly about Christopher Villalva. He's the first man to be federally executed since the death penalty resumed after this 17-year hiatus. Both he and the ACLU decided to turn his case into a racial justice issue. Now, to be clear, he was executed last week. It's done. But beforehand, he was trying to stop it, as you would expect. And the ACLU was trying to stop it, as you would expect. But they did it in such a ridiculous and disingenuous way. Because they're phrasing this as him being the first black man to face the federal death penalty. And with it, it brings up all of these equity arguments. Here he is in a video before the execution that the ACLU posted to try to change public opinion.
People are not being informed about the racial disparity on federal death row. Black people are only 13% of this country's population. You know, we are almost half the population of federal death row. That's been used disproportionately against black people for decades. People are unaware of the fact that many of us here were arrested before we were old enough to drink.
He was arrested before he was even old enough to drink. The death penalty disproportionately impacts black people. No allegation that he was punished more harshly due to his race. Just a lot of people in jail are black, disproportionate number. Which we can certainly have a bigger conversation about, and I think that it's a worthy one. But let's hear the hot take from the ACLU.
Since Christopher's trial in 2000, new research has emerged to show how brain development leads to the emotional reactivity and poor decision-making that characterizes teenagers. No one should be executed for a crime they committed as a juvenile.
It was just a poor decision as a result of his teenage brain. New science backs that up. No one should be executed for a mistake they made as a juvenile is what the ACLU tweeted. Now, when you hear juvenile, what age do you think of?
14.
What about 16?
Yeah.
15? Because I skipped.
Yeah, I guess you did skip, yeah. And it kind of threw me off. But yeah.
And maybe even 17, right?
Sure, yeah, 17.
He was 19 at the time. He was 19. By the way, the same activists who tell us 16-year-olds should vote say 19-year-olds can't be held accountable for a crime because their brains aren't fully developed yet. They're a little bit too reactionary. Let's talk briefly about what it is he did, which, by the way, he admits to doing. You see, Christopher Villalva was a gang member in Killian, Texas. He convinced a married couple from Iowa to give him and a friend a ride. They were hitchhiking. Now, this couple from Iowa, they were actually on their way home from church. He pulled a gun on them. He stuffed them into the trunk of his car, of their car, while he tried to steal from them. He tried to get into their bank accounts. He only got into the ATM and got $100. He tried to pawn their wedding rings. Now, during the several hours that this couple spent in the trunk of the car, they could be heard telling the kidnappers, Christopher and his friend, to embrace Christianity. You see, they were deeply devout. And they were trying to get this monster to come over from the dark side and go towards light. Didn't work. Because he pulled that car over into a remote part of the Texas city, opened up that trunk, and shot them both in the head. And then he set the fire to the car. He set fire to this vehicle. Turns out, the gunshot wound killed the husband, but not the wife. The wife ended up dying from smoke inhalation. Of all the people on death row who deserve to be there, he certainly qualified. Telling me that you did this when you were 19 years old because of, you know, underdeveloped brain, not really a moving argument, ACLU. Turns out there are a lot of 19-year-olds who don't viciously murder people like this. Now, you can go ahead and turn this into some kind of racial issue if you want. That people on death row are disproportionately black. Okay. Did he commit the crime? Is your argument that we should let him off or put more white criminals on death row? If it's putting more white criminals who are murderers on death row, I'm all in. Sign me up. Saying that not enough white people are on death row doesn't mean the black criminal, in this case, on death row, shouldn't be there. He got exactly what was coming. He got exactly what he deserved. You're listening to The Jason Rancho. When we come back, another riot, but this time with a twist in Seattle.